Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more at the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. John Waters, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. Good to be back.
It's great to talk to you, man. And you're not in the studio, man. I have my striped socks on.
Oh, well, I have pretty good socks on, too. I mean, business friendly with it. It said only in L.A. do they give you makeup for the radio. So we both have on socks. We can describe them. What do yours look like?
Mine are striped. They are kind of beige, black, turquoise, green, and blue. A little white.
Mine have crooked stripes on them that look like there's something the matter with them. And so all foot fetishes everywhere are now getting off to our socks.
They are. They are. We have to get people started.
Yeah.
It's great to hear your voice. I love this book.
Well, thank you very much.
I had to pry it from Valerie's fingers to read it so I could get ready for the show. She would not let it go.
Homework to do, right.
I had to read it. That's one of the things. One of the things in this book, before I ask you about your hero, since we're starting up about books, is that you have a great line there about books. Your line is, "Nothing's more impotent than an unread library."
Well, that's true.
I love that line.
But worse is no library.
Right.
At least if you buy the books, you pretend to have read them, which is the worst. I'm the unashamed person. I mean, you go into the house and there's not one book. You should run out the door, I think. Call the police.
Let's talk about this whole notion of role models, because it's not as if every one of these role models is somebody you grew up with and panted for. These are people that – it's everything. People that you grew with, people that grew into your life, as well as folks that you...
Well, it's somebody that I could sort of tell my own memoirs through them, in a way. It's all people that have led lives certainly more extreme than mine, sometimes with great success, like Johnny Mathis, sometimes great horror, like Leslie Van Houten, as she looks back on the crime she committed with Charles Manson, to Bobby Boris Pickett, who wrote The Monster Mash, who I'm secretly jealous of, because he never had to think of a new idea ever again. He just sang that song for the rest of his life.
I mean, when you wrote about... Johnny Mathis. It was interesting. That's how you started your book off, talking about him.
Well, I didn't know Johnny Mathis, and I have to this day, even though I've only met him twice, I have no idea if he knew who I was or not. But it was hard to get to him because Johnny Mathis doesn't do press. And I know that his show, even when it played the Lyric in Baltimore, his Christmas show, was completely sold out. No publicity. He doesn't even have to support his fame. He's beyond fame. So he's the exact opposite of me. I mean, I'm doing a press tour. Every day I do 12 interviews. He doesn't do any ever and is way more successful. And he is the opposite. He appeals to the general middle class of America. He's very loved. He's been around for 40 years. He's had great success from the very, very beginning. But I like the opposite of me sometimes. I don't want to hang around with people that are always like me. It's boring. That's why I don't live in L.A., because nobody I meet isn't in show business. So when I finally got to meet him, he let me in, but the lawyer was sitting there, so I knew that he rightfully didn't trust me. I wouldn't either if I was Johnny Mathis. But I think once we talked, he really loosened up. The lawyer laughed. He didn't even stay. And Johnny Mathis was lovely, and when we went to see him in Baltimore, he couldn't have been lovelier. And we are very opposites in the same way. He's a Republican. I'm certainly not. But still, he is an extreme that I am fascinated by, and he was a kind, wonderful man.
Johnny Mathis, Republican. That, I had no idea.
Well, you never know. So is Tab Hunter. So are a lot of people. One of my assistants is Republican. I give her credit for having the balls to work for me all those years. It must be torture, especially at election time.
I mean, Tab Hunter, Republican. That's another one I didn't know. Tab Hunter,
Republican. And he told me that the day that... that Divine and he were going to make out in the movie. And I thought, well, that's astounding to me. But you know what? You don't assume. Liberals get on my nerves sometimes, too, for just assuming that every person believes like what they believe. I don't fit in anywhere.
That's a good thing, though.
I think it is. I don't want to.
One of the things I said when I was coming over to the station, I looked about it. I said, one of the things I love about just talking to John when we do these is that you're just there. You're honest about who you are. There's no BS. There's no like camouflage.
Well, I the only person that ever said to me, you know, neither of us can really be blackmailed by Cheryl Green, Lana Turner's daughter who killed Johnny Stompanato. She said, "We tell it all, you know, what are we going to do?"
They can't. Right? It's all there. So Johnny Mathis. I mean, you were. I love when you kind of were trying to figure out would he like your home.
Well, I said when I looked around his house, I saw, you know, a signed copy of Nixon's book displayed, and I thought, well, what would he think if he looked around my house? My house is, I'm used to it, but to someone who didn't know, who walked around my house, they would be horrified to see a crucifix lighter on the table, or, you know, things that could make certain people as run screaming from the house. What I certainly didn't at Johnny Mathis's. But everyone's house is different. Everybody, what they collect is radically different. And when you're in someone's house, it's the most personal thing. So I tried to imagine if Johnny Mathis and I just switched our lives for one day. We both have a Christmas show. If I came out and sang When Sunny Gets Blue, and he talked about chubby chasers who were eroticized by Santa. Imagine both of our audience running in horror.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, you never know. Who ever thought my career could happen? I've believed that anything could happen for a long, long time.
There's a couple of things that really hit me. I didn't know. I also, since we're just about the same age, I also was a Howdy Doody fan.
Right.
I never sat in the peanut gallery. You did.
I did. My parents used it. My uncle Somerset got me on the show through connections. And that show was really hard to get on. It would be like getting on America's, you know, one of these America's Idol audience. Well, I don't even know. Do they have audience? I don't know.
And summer, fall, winter, spring.
Well, I love that name, and Clarabelle, you can see Divine look like Clarabelle, basically, the makeup. And what fascinated me was the actor who played Clarabelle later became Captain Kangaroo.
That's amazing.
Imagine his life of being two of the biggest characters ever on children's television. I mean, it must have been astounding.
What I didn't know, though, and I don't know why, there's a lot of things I didn't know as I read these books that I want to ask you about, but I had no idea that Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring was also in Jailhouse Rock, and she died
right then. She was killed in a car accident then. And I was fantasizing about wanting to go to the funeral, but I was not invited. when I was a teenager, I so wanted to go to her funeral.
It's Princess Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring.
And Jailhouse Rock, yep.
And Jailhouse Rock, and you in the story about Johnny Mathis, you also write about another person who you always wanted to meet, who you absolutely loved, Patty McCormick.
Yeah, and she played Rhoda Penmark, the killer child in The Bad Seed, and I actually had talked to her one time before I met her again for the book. I was the guest speaker at a horror convention in New Jersey at the Chiller Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in the audience and I'm doing my one-man spoken word act. And at the end, the woman in the audience said, I know that you like The Bad Seed. Talk about that. So I talked about it and then she said, because I am Patty McCormick. And the whole audience went crazy, right? And she stood up. And then, you know, I called her for the book and she was lovely and she's really great, and she talked about it for a while. She got sick of it. She just refused to talk about it anymore because she said, you feel bad if you haven't had another big hit. But then she got used to it, and then she said that she grew Rhoda up and learned to be really happy that anybody gets a role that is that remembered for that long. And she later played Pat Nixon in the Nixon Frost movie, so she's still playing scary women at the end. Although I kind of like Pat Nixon. There's a book about her called The Lonely Lady of San Clemente, where she just walks around chain-smoking in private. And I don't know, I felt bad for Pat Nixon. And whenever I stay in the presidential suite, which sometimes I do in hotels, if I'm in the old days when I made movies that studios produced and they paid the bill, I would look at the bed and think, she didn't get laid here. In the presidential suite, as I snuggled under the covers. I thought that.
Well, I guess you have to feel sorry for Pat Nixon that way. I mean, she's Pardon? You have to feel sorry for her.
Yeah, I didn't dislike Pat Nixon.
No, when you describe the books that are in your house, you have this love affair with terrorists.
Well, I wouldn't call it that. I'm interested in true crime. I mean, terrorists to me are. They're interesting, yes. I mean, the shoe bomber, the most shocking one, he looked like one of the Three Stooges. How did he think he was going to get on a plane looking like Mo Howard with fuses coming out of your shoes? Excuse me, can I borrow your big pet lighter? You know, I mean, huh? I mean, and this new one, you know, I don't know. You were saying that because I showed United 93 at the Maryland Film Festival.
You did that, right? You showed that, and you have, you love, they have the Carlos the Jackal book on your
bookshelf. Now they're making a big new, the movie in Cannes this year, the five-hour movie about Carlos the Jackal got rave reviews. I didn't even know they were making it. I just read about it. Carlos the Jackal, I'm certainly, well, he was notorious, and I love the fact that he got married in prison to a very, very wealthy left-wing woman lawyer who they have a happy marriage. It's astounding to me. You know, I'm interested in extreme lives and personalities and how people somehow live these lives that are so different than how anybody else, including me, has grown up.
Now, when you talk about this, the I don't know if I should be giving all this stuff away because you want people to read this book, but
there's a lot in the book. I don't think
we're not giving it all away. But the cult graveyard that my children have to look forward to.
Well, you know, Divine is buried in a graveyard in Towson, and I went pricing graveyards, and they were trying to rip me off everywhere. So I called. They saw me coming. They thought they were like saw that Valentino's crypt or something. And they were offering me prices. I said, "You could be kidding!" And I don't know how much graves cost. So I went home and called because I liked the little graveyard in Towson where Divine is buried. And the woman was lovely. And so I bought a graveyard. I bought a double, so I got room around me. And then Pat Moran and her husband bought two, and Dennis Dermody, my friend, and Mink Stoll. So we call. Yeah, it's like the People's Temple graveyard. Come on down. But I'm trying to talk others into being buried with us there. I love the idea. It's one-stop shopping. And I like graveyards. And this graveyard I used to go to when we were young. It was near where I grew up. So I love the idea.
Which graveyard is it?
It's in Towson. It's the one right in the – I'm just not home, so I don't have a name. What's it called? It's in the – where Delaney Valley Road and York Road split. Right.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's right there.
John Waters is with us. This is not taped. He's live. 410-319-8888 is the number. You can join us or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Unless you listen to it next year, then it will be taped, but it's not taped now. His latest book is Role Models, 410-319-8888. Now, you unearthed a whole part of Tennessee Williams. I love Tennessee Williams, but I will have to admit that I did not read Baby Doll, and I have not read some of the ones that you fell in love with.
Well, Baby Doll was the famous movie. I mean, of course.
Right, that was a movie, right.
A book,
right.
Too. Well, it's a screenplay book you can buy. But Baby Doll was the one that the nuns went crazy about in the 50s, and Cardinal Spellman had hissy fits about. And that great poster of her sucking her thumb lying in the crib. Oh, my God, I never got over it. Never got over it.
But Tennessee Williams had a deep influence with you. This is one of the first books you stole.
Well, I stole it because they wouldn't give it to me in the Towson Library. They had a thing that said, see librarian, and I'm against that. And I think libraries, I've been the main speaker at library conventions, and they all cheer when I say, give a kid any book he wants. But in some communities, they're not allowed to. And I think if a kid has heard of Baby Doll and he's 8 years old, God knows he should be able to read it. I don't think any bad book ever hurt a kid when he's 8 years old. I'd just be glad he's reading. Because all the books that I had to read when I was young were so boring, I didn't read till I was a teenager. I rebelled against it. I didn't want to read The Life of Benjamin Franklin. That's not going to turn anybody into a reader. Give them, you know, I wanted to read Street Rod and Hot Rod and books like that. So I believe that you should encourage children to read young, but let them sometimes read a book that the school didn't make them read.
Now,
but that book certainly affected me because Tennessee Williams, I just knew that he wrote about a world that I didn't know was there, certainly in Lutherville, Maryland, but I wanted to go to that world. I didn't really want to be like everybody else. And I'm not saying I was that blasé that I never had a rough time in school, but I didn't really have a rough time in school because the people that would beat me up knew I hated authority even more than they did. So they left me alone. And the bad girls, I always was their best audience. And they knew it. I didn't even know some of them, but I just watched them every day, and they performed for me. It was like being a director.
That's where it started.
Yeah, from voyeurism of delinquents.
Well, one of the things, though, about Tennessee Williams that before we move on is that I mean, he was a real tragic figure in some ways.
To me, he was not tragic. I mean, certainly, yes, he struggled with alcohol and liquor, but, you know, in the arts, that's an occupational hazard, I'm afraid. People in the arts always have issues and problems. That's why they go in a business that forces them to seek approval from strangers for the rest of their life. A person that's well-adjusted doesn't need strangers to tell them good.
It's true. Now, I think one of the most amazing and sensitive chapters that I've read anywhere is what you wrote about Leslie Van Houten.
Well, I care. It's the only chapter in the book that isn't funny. I don't think
it's
there's any jokes.
No, there's no
I don't mean there to be any jokes. It's not funny. It's a horrible story. And it was very, very hard for her to finally read it. A friend said, how would you feel reading like 14,000 words of the worst night of your life? But yet she wrote me a letter and said how really incredibly thankful she was because her family was so moved by it. And, you know, it's not a lot of people stick up for somebody that was met a madman when she was 19, did a terrible thing. But yet, you know, she got life, not life without parole. She was 17 when she met a madman, but she owns the crime and takes such responsibility for it that she doesn't just blame Manson and drugs, because she said, it's my fault for being in the cult that made him a leader in the first place. And she looks back on him, she thinks he's just a disgusting old man now. I mean, it's not, she has lived in remorse for 40 years and done every single thing the prison has told her to do. And one judge even recently overruled the parole board by saying, look, you can't just keep saying the severity of the crime is the only reason to keep her in, because she can't change that. Everything else, she's changed. And she has apologized and taken responsibility in, I think, a very intelligent way when she speaks about it. But yet, if you don't believe in rehabilitation, I understand. I quote the meanest things, not mean, the most outraged things that the victim's family say against the release, which I have to do, to be fair. I would never criticize them from their viewpoint at all. It was their family. It was a terrible thing.
But there are a couple of things about this particular woman. I mean, I was really fascinated by two things. A was the story of what drove you to her in the first place, to start writing to her to try to talk with her. And
well, in the beginning, I'm guilty too, because I used the Manson trial as comedy, I you know, in a punk rock way, the same way Marilyn Manson became Marilyn Manson, by taking this symbol of something that all parents hated, and the boogeyman worse than Freddie was Charlie Manson, and I made jokes about it, and I was drawn to that. I went to the trial. I visited Tex Watson. I was drawn to it. I've never gotten over that trial. That trial caused Pink Flamingos to be made. I'm still not over it. That's why I became friends with Leslie. But I originally went to her to interview her for Rolling Stone, and she said, I don't want to be in a magazine for the terrible thing I did. So we became friends, and I never wrote about her for 20-some years until this book came out. And finally I said, well, can I write about how your rehabilitation? And she said yes. But I wrote in the beginning, I went not so much to Leslie, but when I was Pink Flamingos being dedicated to them, I didn't know them then or anything. And Tex Watson, I mean, and there's the worst case. I mean, he did it all, really.
Right.
But he was Manson's best piece of work. He was just a kid that came from Texas looking for grooviness, and 10 months was turned into a robot. I mean, one of the other girls said the killers couldn't even form a thought. And I think Leslie describes to me how the acid and the mind control broke down when she was on death row, that suddenly she would start mouthing this stuff. It would be like a machine that was caught. The gears didn't work. And she would start to say something, and she would realize it didn't make sense. And it took 3 years with shrinks and the workers in the prison for her to suddenly begin to realize that Helter Skelter wasn't going to happen. This was some terrible thing. And imagine the horrible realization that was. And that realization has taken through psychiatric treatment and work of bettering herself and trying to finally become the woman that she would have been if she never met him.
Well, that's the part that really hit me. When you write in this chapter about her that you write, if Leslie had met me instead of Charlie Manson, or Charlie, could she have gone to the Cannes Film Festival instead of the California Institute for Women?
I mean, well, I think we were crazy then, too, but we had this outlet. We made all the antisocial things in our movies. We made in movies. We put in movies. But they couldn't distinguish from real life in fantasy. I mean, they were at war, too. We were, too, at war. I mean, I made movies in the height of the hippie thing that violated that everything, that made fun of violence, everything, for humor. And for, I guess, what was punk rock, even though there was no name for that yet. But what they did, they were the filthiest people alive. I mean, they caused Pink Flamingos to be made. But at the time, looking back on it now, I asked Leslie, did you ever feel cool? And she looked at me with horror and basically said, we had no concept what that word even could possibly mean in the state of mind that we were when that happened. She started out as a hippie girl looking for a leader like millions of hippies did. And by the time it got to be the point where the violence was, they were so far gone. I mean, she thought she was an elf. A killer elf. How do you tell the parole board that you were on acid and believed you were a killer elf? How do you explain to the parole board that? I can understand it, to be honest.
But one of the things that really—I mean, maybe I don't want to make too much of this—but when you've seen her now for 24 years, you said in that chapter, and you become friends.
Yes, certainly.
And I think about what happens to people when they're very young, and just a twist of fate. I mean, instead of making movies with John Waters and dropping acid and enjoying life and being insane, you drop acid with a madman and temporarily become...
What can happen, yes, that's true. And that you don't know, you know, when the trial was going on, one of her co-defendants, Patricia Krenwinkel, kept referring to it as this play we're in.
Right.
She thought she was in a play. I mean, it's hard for people to imagine this kind of insanity thinking if they never took LSD, to be honest. And, it's a tough one, and I'm not saying that excuses it. I'm not saying she shouldn't have gone to jail.
She doesn't excuse it.
3 years is a long time. It's never going to change what happens.
She doesn't excuse it.
But she didn't think up the crime. I'm sticking up for her now. She doesn't say this. She says, I take responsibility for every single thing that happened that night because I was part of it. But in my mind, to stick up for her, if I was a lawyer, and in a way I am in this chapter, she did not think up this crime. She would have gone any night. They all would have. It's just he pointed to her that night.
And
people would say, well, other people didn't have to do that. And it's true. I mean, you know, if I had told Mink Stoll to go kill somebody, she wouldn't have.
No.
You know, but, I mean, I told Divine to eat dog dude. That was our Kate Labia. You know, I don't mean that making fun of it. It was a cultural crime, which was done for humor. The same way Manson told him to creepy crawl, I could imagine how that was fun, breaking into people's houses on acid and not hurting them, just watching them sleep and move the furniture. There's something appealing about that to me. I hate to say it.
That's theater.
Yeah.
On some levels, that's theater.
Anarchy.
I mean, but you write about how we'll move on to the other stuff from the book, but you write about how she, you know, how other people from that period, whether it's William Calley, who murdered all these people at My Lai, came out of jail, or the Bader Meinhof gang that killed 34 people, they're freed.
And they didn't even say they were sorry. The weirdest thing about it is that in America, in the beginning, even Bugliosi, the prosecutor who wrote Helter Skelter, said that Leslie would probably do 20 years for her part. But the case got bigger and bigger, and Manson became a Halloween costume. It became movies. It became so many things. I'm sorry, the other phone's ringing. I can't do anything about it. It became a legend of its own. They keep making these movies. They keep doing this stuff, and there's nothing really she can do to stop that. And one year she didn't even go to the parole hearing because they were outside selling parole tapes of her hearing, and court TV would show it, and they'd say, like, that was a great performance, and she thought, this is terrible. You know, this is when the victims are there, victims' families and everything, it became this product that was sold.
I love that picture of the two of you. Where was that taken?
In the visiting room. Where else?
That's why couldn't be too many places. I'm just curious.
What happened in the visiting room, you pose, and it's still like this in jail. For $5 or whatever the price is, you can get your Polaroid picture taken with the prisoner you visit in front of a backdrop. In the 24 years I've been there, that backdrop has changed maybe 4 times. And that picture hangs on my bulletin board privately in my house, in my office. And people that look at it, they would say, was that your sister? Was that at a high school reunion? I mean, no one could imagine. I mean, she lives in mortification of every time they show that newsreel that they will show till the end of time of the three girls walking down the hallway singing that Manson song, laughing on their way to death row. And that is an image that is pretty hard to ever, ever get beyond.
It really is. She's a gorgeous woman. So I just, and besides, it just raises so many issues. That chapter really shook me. More than anything else that you've written, I think, really kind of made me stop.
We have to talk some about the victims, and I want to stress
yes. In
that chapter, I say a lot about the victims and
yes. Why
they are against her, and they with very good reasons. I understand what they're saying, and the banality of having to go to those hearings, have to buy an outfit to be photographed and to pay for parking, to relive that when their privacy is gone. The LaBianca name was a good family name. It wasn't something that became part of a horror cycle. And there's nothing they can do about that.
We're talking with John Waters. He's got a new book out called Role Models, 410-319-8888. We're going to take a very brief break. And we come back from this break, we're going to explore all kinds of things, people many of you maybe never heard of, or maybe you have, like Bobby Garcia, the great Zorro from Baltimore here, and Little Richard, and more. 410-319-8888. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Yes. No, this is Mark Steiner, not Little Richard, and he's not on the show. But John Waters is with his new book, Role Models. And one of the funniest chapters in the book is about Little Richard.
Well, I still like Little Richard. I wish I could start over with him. Our initial meeting went well until I started asking him questions about the book he had just published, about his life. And it is eye-popping, the book, but I was interviewing him for Playboy. I don't know why he would think I wouldn't ask him about some of the sexual things that he admitted in the book. But that's Little Richard's problem. He is religious and rock and roll. And those two worlds are hard to cross over in.
I mean, you in your books there. Oops, there goes my microphone. It's a little limp there. that in your book there are a lot of freaks, a lot of crazy people, a lot of people on the edge. But Little Richard was. I mean, he's.
Well, you don't think he's on the edge?
No, I do. I do. I do. He's really on the edge.
He always has been. The very first time I ever saw him as a child, I couldn't believe my eyes. What the hell is this? And that's why I, instantly stole his look when I was older and still wear his look proudly over my lip.
That's right. Your mustache is his mustache.
Homage to Little Richard. Certainly, he was the first person to really have it.
That's interesting.
The Platters had it, too. And certainly, store detectives in 30s movies always had them. I don't know why store detectives would have them. You're not supposed to notice the store detectives.
It made me think of Al Sharpton, who wears his hair in a conch because of James Brown.
Well, certainly. But he seems to wear it without irony, which is confusing to me.
I mean, it has to be disappointing, though. I mean, you go to see this guy who you loved. I mean, his style of dress, his craziness, his madness, his being openly gay out there. And there.
Well, he never used that word then.
No, he didn't use the word.
The sisters, they used the word flamboyant. That
right.
was the code word.
Flamboyant, right.
Yeah.
And he wanted you to sign that paper. That was really funny.
The what?
He wanted you to sign that paper.
At the end, he said, you have to sign this paper. He has to approve everything I wrote. I said, Little Richard, that's sort of a violation of amendments that we have in the Constitution about free press. And he said, Michael Jackson does this. Elizabeth Taylor does this. And I thought, well, I'm not so sure. But anyway, the whole thing turned out at the end. I got the story for Playboy. And I would like to try and meet him again and start over. I've never seen him since then.
Never.
And he's still alive and he's still performing. That's amazing. What an amazing life he's had.
Oh, absolutely.
And now Little Richard. Is there a rap star that isn't named Lil something?
Right. Now, I never knew something. Where's this page on Little Richard? I got to find this thing. You wrote about him, this one thing where he was talking to you, and he said, I got to put that page, where he said all the people who had played, here it is. There's only one originator. There's only one architect, Little Richard. I love that. I saw that in so many write-ups. And when the people say my music inspired them, the Beatles, when James Brown was my vocalist, when Jimi Hendrix was my guitarist, when Joe Tex was singing with me, Otis Redding, when Billy Preston was my organist at 13, it makes me feel good.
I guess it would. And modesty has never been a concern of Little Richard.
But they all did play for him.
Yeah, they did, yeah. And then he talks about having threesomes with Buddy Holly.
Right. It's just...
But I didn't ask if his glasses were on or off. You know, I think, you know, he could have gotten even more uptight if I had followed through as a good journalist, as I should have.
We're talking with John Waters, his book, Role Models, 410-319-8888. And Dave in Baltimore City, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Dave, you're on the air.
Hey. Mr. Waters, I had the unique privilege of carrying you in a taxi cab probably 20 years ago down to Charles Street with some of your friends. Memorable experience.
Uh-oh. Well, if I was in a cab, it probably meant we were drinking and not driving, so that was a good evening, right?
Well, I didn't complain.
All right.
I saw a cartoon in the New Yorker magazine some time ago. It's interesting you mentioned, what's his name, Al Sharpton and his James Brown haircut.
Mm-hmm.
In this cartoon, takes place in like a high-rise in Manhattan, say, and there's this 55-year-old couple really, you know, ensconced in their leather chairs and with their martinis, and their young daughter has come before them in the living room, and she has this wonderful spiked haircut and these earrings and tattoos and, you know, the tennis shoes and blue jeans and the whole thing. And the caption is, "But Mom, I just want to be a nonconformist like everybody else." And my question is don't you think that when we're dissatisfied with the company that we're accustomed to and that we look to greener pastures and move towards things that attract us, that when we arrive there, we certainly have the very human tendency of conforming to the very nonconformity that we...
Yes, I believe in a way that's why I'm proud to say that I'm an insider now. I'm the establishment, which is the ultimate ridiculous thing that's ever happened to me. I can't say I'm really struggling. I have, you know, I live in four cities. I have a nice career. Everything I've wanted to happen in my life has happened. So I am the establishment now, which is really weird and funny. And now parents bring me their kids.
Yeah.
They have tattooed faces and bolts in their eyelids and say, what can I do with them?
You know. So the interesting thing is I think that some of these children with the tats and the spiked haircuts, they're looking from where they sit now, and they're looking out to institutions like the Republican Party and the church, and they're wanting to bolt.
Oh, I don't know. I think all kids, that, you know, it's kids' duty to get on their parents' nerves through fashion. That is the point of being a teenager. And I think you have to embrace that. If your kid is causing trouble in high school, be glad. They're going to end up in the arts. Everybody that's the prom queen and the football star and the prom queen, their life is downhill the day they graduate from high school, believe me. The kids that end up in the arts and had some trouble in school, they were the bad influences. Be glad your kid's rebelling in some way, but support him or her, and if they have any interest, if your daughter has a tattooed face, help her open a tattoo shop. You got to work with what you got. You can't order your kids up. We can't order our parents up.
There you go. Dave, thanks for that call. 410-319-8888 with John Waters and his really new, engaging book. I really like this book, Role Models.
Thank you.
I really do. Now, Baltimore Heroes.
Yeah. That chapter's in the new Playboy, which I love. Zorro's finally in Playboy.
Oh, she's in Playboy?
Yeah.
I got to check that out. But but Zorro, you took me back because I...
You remember?
Oh, my God. I got to tell you this story real fast. Then we're going to focus on your story, which is what we're here for. But when I was 16 years old, there was a barber in my neighborhood, and he asked me to take a bag all the time, and he gave me money for this, from his barbershop to, of all places, the Oasis. He said, don't look in the bag, and don't look at whatever they give you to bring back. Do not open the bag. I said, I never did. I said, I'm not on the bag. But I would go there and drop it off, and it was at the Oasis. And the girls would be there, and this was Zorro's Club.
Yep.
And I didn't know her, but I knew who she was. And Julia Salisbury was my dad's patient.
Yeah, well, she brought Julia Salisbury in drag to the airport. I think I broke that story. That's been a mystery for a long time, what happened to him. And Zorro's daughter told me that Zorro got him in drag because she was the only one that wore a size 11 high heel that he could fit into. And she drove him to BWI Airport in drag, and that's the last anybody ever saw of him.
Amazing. But to tell us the story, Zorro was just, I mean...
Zorro was a stripper, a lesbian stripper who looked like Johnny Cash. So she had a great body, but the face of Johnny Cash. And she, at the end of her career, would just snarl at the man, what are you looking at? And I loved her and wrote about her in one of my books just a little bit. And then I read the Sun obituary of her when she died, and it said that she had a daughter. I thought, Zorro had a daughter? That's mind-boggling. So I wrote her daughter, who, of course, became the source of this whole chapter, who told me the entire story of what it was like to be Zorro's daughter, where she led a double life. At home, she was 8 years old, sometimes making $1,000 a night at Zorro's poker parties in the house after the block let out. But at the same time, she went to Notre Dame and was the president of her class. She was 11 years old, driving her mother's Lincoln Continental to pick her up drunk from bars. It's kind of an amazing story. And the daughter, really nobody knew the story about her. And she lives in Oregon now, and I told her, you know, that it was in Playboy. And she has recently been separated, but she has a lovely life, great kids, really nice. And she gave the magazine to the new man she was dating and said, oh, there's a few things you don't know about my upbringing. Wow, you know, what a story. But it's really a good story because
it's a great story.
She had what the authorities would have thought was the worst mother ever. However, she turned out fine. And I write about Esther Martin, who owned the Club Charles. It used to be the Wigwam. And all her kids tell stories about what, you know, an insane mother some would have thought she would have been, but an incredibly colorful woman who could not stop cussing. Really, I have never heard of a fouler mouth on a woman. And I loved Esther, and she was a great friend to me. And both these kids, they all turned out fine, even though their parents would be the textbook of what most people would think would be terrible parents.
I mean, and this is what struck me about Zorro was, I mean, she had a child before lesbians wanted babies.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. Here is a, you know, I'm a gay man writing a story about a bad lesbian mother in Playboy. Talk about politically incorrect. But, you know, lesbians have the right to be bad mothers, too.
Yes, everybody has that right.
Yeah. All gay people don't have to be good. That's the new thing that's making me crazy. We have to be more outstanding than Robert Young and Father Knows Best.
Well, you made this statement on my show once. You said, that you long for the time. He said, that your whole world is turned upside down because people want to get married. You can go into the army and have kids. You thought you were free of that.
Yeah. Now, gay people have more children than Catholics. I know. But I'm for gay marriage, of course. I don't want to do it. I don't want to imitate it. Something that most heterosexuals do badly. At least in my generation, they did.
It's true. I think almost everybody's generation, they just didn't get divorced before.
No, my parents had a great marriage. They had a happy marriage for 50 years.
That's true. You are. You do. That's true. That's true. And, well, you know, that's a good thing.
That's why I'm a healthy neurotic.
You're a successful neurotic.
Healthy neurotic. No, that doesn't mean nothing to do with success. Well, that's emotional success, maybe.
You like living alone, though, don't you?
Oh, my God, yeah. I couldn't imagine anyone that would allow me to let them live in the house with it so decorated to my taste, I wouldn't like.
I mean, even that chapter you have on roommates.
Well, my roommates are the artists I work
right.
with. Yeah. No, I have a great life. I'm alone, I'm not lonely. I couldn't imagine living with somebody right now. I live in four cities. My friends are my long-term relationship. You know, I certainly have romantic, I have people I see, but I don't want to live with people. I don't need that. I don't need another person to make me feel whole.
That's an important thing to be able to do. That's a hard thing in this world.
Well, it didn't seem that hard to me, but that's because I'm a healthy neurotic.
Well,
I don't want what most people want. I never did.
Let me tell you, there are two chapters here where you turn me on to stuff I never knew before. This is one of them, the chapter on your roommates, the artists.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these artists I really wasn't aware of, and you made me kind of Google them all and kind of look at their work for the first time. Like Cy Twombly.
Right.
Amazing.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Cy Twombly, obviously, but most people, even that like contemporary art, draw the line at him. And they say, oh my God, his work makes people angry. Well, that's what contemporary art's supposed to do. It's supposed to make you angry. It is a secret. And we can see something you can't because you have contempt for investigation.
and Moira Davey.
Yeah,
talk about her.
Artist that not very many people know, and her work is purposely pitiful. I mean, she just takes, like, she doesn't clean her apartment and takes pictures under the chair, or old albums filed the wrong way so you can't even read the labels. I mean, she's a sloppy housekeeper who's made it pay off artistically. Everybody has a Moira Davey still life in their house. They try to hide them, but she takes photos of these most unremarkable things in your house, and I find that kind of beautiful.
Now, have you met her?
Yes.
And tell me about her.
Well, she's very shy. She's very anything but like a strong, boisterous personality. She's kind of a shrinking violet, but she's lovely and she's very, very smart. She wrote a great art book called The Problem of Reading, where every day she agonizes which book to read because there's so many, so she doesn't read any of them. I think she's very droll.
And her stuff, I was looking at a photograph of her before I went on the air. This is like, it's just a dog's paw standing on something.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out
what she did a lot of close-ups of pennies, too. She does very unremarkable photographs, and I think that's important.
And going back to Peter Fischel, right?
Yeah, Fischel Weiss is two people together. They work together, two men.
And it's this almost like found pieces that they create?
No, they're not found pieces. I mean, they just take giant, unremarkable photos, again, that look like the third reject of a business calendar. Or they do just trompe-l'oeil, like just pieces of wood that you'd find on the floor. Or they do still life, where they just make the bed look like the Swiss Alps, like a plate is a lake and the pillows are the mountains. They're very droll, too. And they're artists I like very much. They're Swiss artists, and I've written about their work a lot, and I collect their work. And so really the chapter's about my art collection and why I like the kind of art I do.
And so when you looking for this stuff, I mean, how do you find them?
I go to the art galleries in New York every three weeks, about 40 of them. I mean, I follow it very closely because I collect art, I show art in that world, and so it's a world that I'm very interested in. You have to really educate yourself about it.
You've got me turned on to some people I never ever thought about in terms of artists.
Well, next time in New York, go to one of their shows or just get a book from the library about them. I mean, every one of these artists has art books about their work, and you know, in a book, it's even easier to see unremarkable photographs.
John Waters is with us. The book is called Role Models. Another 10 minutes or so, 410-319-8888. Chapter on books, I have to hear once again, I don't know any of these books.
Well, I didn't want to write about – that's good. I want you to go read those books.
I want to check them out. I don't know any of these books.
Well, we need to know about Kevin. That was the only book in there that I think was very successful. But yes, some of them are obscure books, certainly, but they're really extreme books, extreme voices. And I love a feel-bad book. I don't need a book or a movie to make me feel good. I feel good before I start reading it. So a feel-bad book can make me feel great. So sometimes I like depressing pictures of hell.
You do?
Yeah, I love them.
You remember that you did those 10 movies?
Yeah.
And when we were on the show together and I watched them all, and that one movie, oh, man, I still can't – it still gives me nightmares when I think about this movie.
The rape movie?
Yes. Oh, my God.
Well,
oh, my God.
Gaspar Noé, he has a new movie coming out this year. I can't wait to see it.
Oh, I was just – I had to – I couldn't even – when I was
that
watching
was
it –
Irreversible.
Yeah, Irreversible, that one.
That is one of the most horrifying movies ever made.
Oh, my God. I had to actually watch it and turn it – I couldn't – I had to stop and walk away, get a glass of wine, and come back.
Get a glass of wine.
Do something.
Well, see, I like movies like that. It's strong. I never understand why people say, I just like something light, something that makes me feel good. What's the matter with you? Why is the movie's job to make you feel light and better? Go to a shrink and then go to movies. I don't feel it's the responsibility of a book to make you feel good. I think the responsibility of a book is to make you feel smarter.
That's true. That is true. That is true. That is true.
And feeling good and light is generally means stupider, if you ask me.
Well, let's talk about Denton Welsh.
Yeah, Denton Welsh. Oh, he wrote about being a damaged lunatic child. But it was about all the things that children fantasize about. And you've got to understand that the things you worry about your children when you catch them in play doing weird things, that might mean nothing to them. But the things that they deeply, their inner fantasy life is so important to be encouraged as a child and not stifled. And if you stifle it, later in life, they're going to have neurotic behavior because they didn't get to have that fantasy when they're young. So this book is about a child's vaguely unhealthy fantasies. But I think his brother is very nice. He catches, at one point, the little child finds a rope and hooks himself up to it and pretends that he's caught and damaged and a slave. And the brother catches him and says, Jesus, stop doing that. People think you're crazy. But that seems like a nice way to try to comprehend children's odd fantasy life. So don't be upset if your kid is doing weird things as a child. Encourage that play, that fantasy. It's important in a kid.
Or the one sentence you have here. Somehow Denton Welsh has captured the undiscovered innocence of the Marquis de Sade and the ingrained perversity that only children can fathom.
Well, that's true, because children don't know there's taboos. They don't know that they're not allowed to think some way or to do something. And sometimes when they're brought up by it from parents or scold them, what? What's the matter with that? And it's the same way. Children always love Divine. They like pink flamingos. If you show a child, which is illegal, pink flamingos, I'm not saying you should. They think it's like the circus. They aren't shocked. Don't kids eat dog shit? I mean, accidentally, it could be worse.
I'm going down to Normals here, so I've got to see if I can find some of these books.
Oh, Normals, that's a great book.
I love that book.
One of my favorite bookshops in the city.
With Christina Steed's The Man Who Loved Children.
Oh, that's a hate-filled. That's about the most hateful marriage ever. It's really a torturous one. You know, I'm having a book signing for this at Atomic Books. I wonder if you should check and see if they have any of the books, too. They might have ordered them because of the book.
Oh, I'll have to do that. When is that book signing?
It is the first Saturday in June. I can take my look at my calendar. I think it's June 5th. Is that the first Saturday in June?
Yes, it is. Yes, it
yes,
is.
It's June 5th.
Oh, I'll have to come down for that. I've just got to
have
it.
Yeah, that'll be good, because that's your kind of bookstore that's, you know, certainly sells the kind of books that I like, extreme books. It's an extreme bookshop.
It is. I love that bookshop.
It's great. I like it too. I like Normals. I like the Ivy. That's a real bookshop. Ivy? Too. One that they don't have much of them anymore.
That's right.
A real bookshop of everything in it, current hardbacks.
Everything. I love that store. We go there a great deal, too.
Yeah.
Now, in the last chapter here, you talk about someone also who I knew as a kid and who my father supported, Madeline Murray O'Hare.
I love Madeline Murray O'Hare, but if you read deep into her, she was a monster, too.
She was a horrible person.
I know. She was the meanest to women and to gay people and to blacks and all the people you'd think that
right.
She would be her supporters. But she's so horrible that you almost burst out laughing when you read some of this behavior she did. But she was my hero, too, because in Catholic school, they they implied that it would be okay to break her windows.
Burn her at the stake.
Yeah. Oh, and at the end, she'd love to be hated, though. She made appearances where she came on stage at colleges on a broomstick. I mean, she loved it when people were mean to her. And she was killed by a man named Waters because she would never shut up. She tormented her kidnappers until they just strangled her whole family to death.
But yet...
She did. I mean, and you could... You could, after you read about it, you get to imagine why everybody didn't strangle her.
I mean, I loved what she was fighting for back then when I was a teenager.
She had bumper stickers that said, "Prayer is begging." I mean, come on, that's funny.
Well, you have some very funny lines in this particular chapter when you talk about teaching us how to levitate.
Levitate if you really concentrate, or at least imagine you do, and then you can speak in tongues, and then you can burst into spontaneous combustion. I believe in all that stuff, and I'm not a religious fanatic, but I like reading about them, because like the shouting ladies that burst into mass and scream the Hail Mary so loudly that they drown out, and the police said they were causing an unholy racket, which really, I love that expression. So I don't believe in what they believe in, but I'm happy they believe in it.
Me too. And I'm glad that you are into the damned, the disinherited, the disrespected, and the despised.
And you know, originally said that, Jesse Jackson, that's who he said.
Right. Right.
Whatever the word is, that's what he said, that's who his people were, and I never forgot that.
John Waters, it's been really great to have you on the air once again.
Thanks for having me on, and it's always a pleasure to do your show.
See you on the 5th.
Okay.
Comic Books.
Bye-bye.
Take care, man. John Waters' latest book, Role Models, really worth the read. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by who this time? It's brought to you by Urbanite. This month, Urbanite explores the city's contemporary art scene and the prospects for leveraging this cultural energy into a force for broader community change. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a complete list of pickup locations. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone, who found Little Richard for us tonight. Our interns tonight, Felicia Faison and Stephanie Mavronis. Our theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, find out more about our guests, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.